I got a swing in my walk. I got a song in my talk. I'm a weekday working woman, weekend queen, a time clock lady with a lazy dream. I ain't got no fancy furs, diamond rings or silks, but I'm just a ride for Saturday night. It's payday at the mill, and it's 8 hours of sewing up collars and sleeves. The pay's too little and I gotta live cheap, so I stitch and I sew.
Good morning. This is Margaret Butler, and welcome to our ongoing series, Oregon Women in Labor. This morning, we're going to be talking with Nita Brueggemann of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. Good morning, Nita.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
You were talking to me a little bit about the number of men who attended the recent AFL-CIO convention and the number of women, and that's relevant to our topic today, which is the involvement in and representation of women in the labor movement. How are women coming along in terms of union representation?
Well, I think women are coming along fine with regards to union representation. My reference was primarily based on women in organized labor that are in decision-making positions in their own unions. And that is not coming about nearly as fast as women are being organized into unions.
So there's a lot of women in the rank and file, but not many calling the shots.
There are very few in Oregon that are in actual decision-making positions. I think, in fact, I had mentioned originally there were two. There are actually four. Alice Dale with OPEU, Kathy Schmidt with American Federation of Teachers, Linda Rasmussen with Communication Workers, and myself with Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers.
All of whom, I may add, we will be speaking to at one time or another in this series.
That you won't have to do very many interviews, though, will you? One of the things that I also had commented on is the fact that I felt that with regard to women participating in the decisions of organized labor at the state level, we took a major step backwards at the last AFL-CIO convention, which took place the 20th through 23rd of August in Coos Bay. We had four women on that board, voting board members. We now have one. The lowest representation in approximately 15 years.
Is this a fluke of the election statistics, or does this actually signify something?
Well, part of it is due to the fact that during a bad economy, the last ones hired have a tendency to be women and minorities. The first ones let go have a tendency to be the same. And that means that there are fewer women, even in rank and file, in unions that are predominantly men. In unions that are predominantly women anyway, frankly, too many of them are represented strictly by men, from the top right down to local offices. And that's a problem that we're going to be concentrating more on. The Coalition of Labor Union Women will be taking a look at a 86 project that indeed is the empowerment of women in unions.
Now, you represent women clothing workers. You represent clothing workers who I think tend predominantly to be women, is that correct?
Right. We, in fact, have a merged union, clothing and textile workers in the Portland area, probably reflect our membership at the national level, which is a woman, age 44, is the actual Act II member. I was surprised at the age level, but that has, again, to do with layoffs and seniority provisions that protect senior workers. That is also the numbers of women in amalgamated clothing dropped with the merger. Textile actually had a lot more men in the rank and file than clothing did. So it brought the numbers down to about 73% from like 86. But still our union is predominantly female by that margin.
You came up through the rank and file of Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, is that correct?
Right.
How was it for you coming out of the clothing factories as a woman involved in labor union bargaining and management?
Well, first of all, I was fairly young. I mean, I was young at that time compared to the people that, the men primarily, that were involved actively in organized labor. So I was young. That was a disadvantage. And I was green. I was new. It was not an easy process. One of the things that after spending 10 years in organized labor, truly believing that organized labor more than other organizations is a vehicle for women to gain some equality in decision-making positions that can really contribute to a movement that this country. I still believe that. What I'm a little disillusioned about is the fact that the process that I've attempted to use and encouraged other women to use in organized labor is not one of confrontation. It has been one of cooperation. It has been one of contribution. It has been one of working side by side with men in organized labor to accomplish the goals. I'm not sure that was the best avenue anymore, and that's part of what I mentioned about the Coalition of Labor Union Women. We simply are not waiting any longer for an equal opportunity to run for an office. We are, in fact, going to be running for offices no matter who else is running. We are going to, in fact, be insisting on appointments. We are going to be doing a number of things. We don't believe that organized labor can say to the women out there who, according to statistics, are the workers that are unorganized in this country, and they need to be. They're in the kinds of jobs that are so exploitable, service sector, be it hospital, restaurant, financial institutions. Service sector jobs are predominantly women, and they're low paid, and they don't have seniority, and they don't have a lot of things. I don't think you can convince women that will represent you if you can't show them that there's also opportunities to represent themselves, the ability to get there and help make the decision to say, we'll take care of you.
Act Two is your union. How is the Oregon-Washington Joint Board as far as women in the union positions?
Well, the Joint Board Manager, which is the position I hold, is held by a woman. The other business agent, that position is held by a woman. The president of the Joint Board is a female. The vice president of the Joint Board is a female. The recording secretary is a male. And then
so
different
token men in there.
Well, actually, he took terrific notes.
Can he type?
He took great notes. He doesn't type, but my secretary does type, so we managed to do it that way. And then various board positions are held by both men and women. But I think our board truly represents the makeup of our membership. Our board is predominantly the key roles, like joint board president, staff, etc., are predominantly women. Interestingly enough, and I think a pleasure for me to finally learn, because I hadn't spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, is that I find no biases on the part of our male rank and file against having female representation. They trust us, we're credible, we do the job, and they have not taken time to say, well, a man could have done a better job. Initially, that was a problem when I was first elected 5 years ago, and I'm up for election in January as well. They work well with us. We make it very clear that, it's a union that, espouses certain rights on the job, and we don't get into any other kinds of issues that aren't important to what's happening on Act II's agenda. So it's been a very good working relationship within Amalgamated and my own membership. I can't say that I've experienced the same confidence from my superiors at times. I have felt much more so that they were thinking, oh, well, she's a woman. And that's a little discouraging.
What are some of the issues in your union, economic issues, work-related issues?
Well, the key issue with Amalgamated Nationwide right now is the two bills that we have in Congress that you currently hear the president trashing, and they're the ones to help protect our industry against huge new imports. And by new imports, the problem of imports having an impact on our industry is about 35 years old. The new problem is that those import levels have doubled in the last 3 years, have cost people in the industry about 300,000 jobs in 4 years, and are costing Amalgamated union members their jobs at the rate of about $8,000 to $10,000 a month. So there are two bills currently in Congress, Bill 1560 and Senate Bill 680, and both of those simply say that we want a share of our market back in America. It does not limit imports with regard to saying we don't want any imports. It just says the 10 major importers into this country will cut back somewhat, allow some of the other importing countries to have a little bit of a share of the market, and guarantee us more. Our industry is the largest remaining manufacturing industry in America. There are more people in clothing and textile jobs in America today than there are in steel, auto, and mining combined.
That's amazing. I don't think we ever think of clothing and textile as one of the major industries.
It is. It wasn't until what's happened with the economy over the last 10 years and our move as a nation away from industrial kinds of unions and into service sector jobs. Interestingly enough, the new jobs that are being created, which are service sector, are female-dominated, and the largest remaining union is female-dominated, and that should tell some folks out there about what this country wants to pay in the way of wages, because neither one of those particular industries pay a whole lot in the way of wages and benefits.
What does clothing work pay in Oregon?
In Oregon, our average rate of pay is probably in the clothing division, which runs somewhat lower than textile. It runs about $5.75 to $6.25 an hour. In textile, it runs about $6.25 to $7 an hour.
How does that compare to comparable jobs?
Well, I think it's certainly considerably lower than what's been happening in timber industry. I think their base is like $12, and ours is down lower. Where it compares with service sector is that it's higher. Actually, clothing and textiles benefit package has always ranked comparatively well with other unions, and that's helped. It's not necessarily been the wages, but we have a decent vacation package, and we do have pension funds, and we have a good health and welfare package that's employer-paid that includes dependent coverage for the most part. So our benefits have been very helpful.
Perhaps one of the major impressions that our listeners have of the clothing and textile industry is from the movie Norma Rae. Have the organizing issues been as difficult as portrayed in the southern cotton mills in that film? Have they been as difficult here in the Northwest?
Organizing has been difficult here, partly, and the organizing I've been involved with, unfortunately the majority of that has been within the framework of the Reagan administration, and the National Labor Relations Board plays a crucial part in organizing in any state. And frankly, you can't depend on the National Labor Relations Board to be fair with unions. The fact is that the appointments to the NLRB have been heavily weighted in favor of companies and corporations. They play a crucial role. What's happening throughout organized labor, in my opinion, is that they're reassessing old traditional organizing techniques and strategies, and that's partly what we're doing now. The other thing is, whenever the economy is bad in organized labor, the first people to be laid off is organizers. They're the last ones hired and the first ones let go. They also have a tendency to be women. And right now, that's what we're in. I mean, as far as organized labor is concerned, we're in something of a recession. That's stabilized in the last year. Our numbers are not dropping. But on the other hand, they're not significantly increasing, except for unions like AFSCME, who are predominantly female membership. And they've had a number of stunning victories in the last 6 months to a year.
And AFSCME is American Federation of...
City, County, Municipal Employees. Was that good? Yeah.
That was close.
We use a lot of initials. We don't necessarily use the full names, but a lot of acronyms there.
What are some of the economic issues facing women in Oregon?
I think that they're the same issues that face working women all over the country, and that is that a lot of employers are coming in with shorter hours to avoid paying full health and welfare benefits, full vacation.
Sounds like TriNet.
Overtime. That's happening all over. I don't care if you're in a hotel, restaurant, our union, it's happening somewhat too. City and county have complained about it. Teachers have always had lots of part-timers. So I think that's a problem. Full-time work with full benefit packages are not necessarily available to the majority of women working in Oregon. Couple that with the fact that they have a tendency to be at lower wage rates to boot, and you've got problems for women and their economies. Our union, and I know we're not exclusive in that, has a lot of single heads of household, female single heads of household.
In other words, you can work full-time and still be poor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've gone to the bargaining table more than once and, you know, screamed at an employer because their full-time workers qualified for food stamps. That's not true these days, only because it's much harder to get food stamps. But until about 4 years ago, too many of our employers in Oregon and Washington, and I'm sure all across the country, our working people were eligible for food stamps, and they needed them. It wasn't a question of everything was so lax that anybody could get on them. It simply was a matter of they qualified because they couldn't feed their families balanced meals on their incomes.
If the state readjusts its pay scales and job descriptions in a comparable worth maneuver, is this going to have any impact on the clothing and textile industries?
It could possibly have some. One of the things about an industrial environment like clothing and textile is that it's not easy to deliberately discriminate because of sex, but there always seems to be those higher paid jobs, mechanics, which women are reluctant to bid into or simply are deemed unqualified, have a higher base rate than sewing machine operators. Cutters, same problem, and those two positions have a tendency to be men. In the textile, where weaving operations and spinning operations could be either men or women, we see one rate of pay. And it's very hard to say whether or not that rate of pay was determined because there are more men there or it's just what they pay for that particular skill. What we do know is that the sewing machine operators, although their base rate may be lower because they're on an incentive system, many of them frankly earn more than the higher rate of pay that's hourly that are predominantly men's jobs.
Does piecework prevail?
Oh, absolutely. In our industry, over 80% of the work is piecework, and it's done for one reason and one reason only. You get more for your money. You get more work for less cost. The incentive system, however, is not something that you would find the workforce abandoning. They like the option of earning more money if they work harder. The other thing I'm seeing as I review labor agreements that come through my office through a number of means is that more and more industries are moving to production bonuses. That's all it is an incentive system like we've had in our industry for years. But a lot of them are getting quarterly production bonuses, department bonuses if your production is more than the other department. So it's similar to the process that we use, the incentive system that we use, except ours is on a daily basis. But they're all going for it. They're all going for more work means more money. But the bottom line is they're still getting a little bit more work than they're actually paying for.
So how do you, as the person who negotiates these contracts, feel about that incentive system?
I guess it's one that I finally have learned to live with because I do truly want to represent the members that are out there and those members believe that the incentive system is one that they will live with. They know that the nature of the industry is such that if they abandoned the incentive system, they would have employers saying, your jobs are only worth $3.45 an hour. They're only worth minimum wage. If I can't get more production because I'm giving you the opportunity to earn more through faster sewing or faster cutting or whatever it may be, that's what will happen. They'll see $3.45 an hour jobs. You know, they'll have the same kinds of problems that some hotel restaurant employees are having with tip credits being part of it and all that. I think that if I'm going to adequately represent the people that I'm elected to represent, that I have to understand that that's a method that they've learned to adjust to and that they actually want. I was an incentive operator. It is a real system of you know, peer against peer. The person in front of you has to sew fast enough to keep you in work, or you have every reason to be angry at them. I don't like the system because of what it does. It doesn't do a lot for unity. But I also can't ask people in the name of unity to abandon a standard of living that they've gotten used to.
How is it organizing women? Do you have a problem building that sense of unity? Women, one of the stereotypes has been that they're difficult to organize, there's not that feeling of solidarity. What's your reaction? You've been organizing women for quite a few years now.
Well, my true belief is that it's garbage, not only from my own experiences, that women are not only fine to organize and they're very cooperative and they're very nurturing and there's just a lot of things about women that lend well to organizing, but that they're strong and that they're good on a picket line and that they don't abandon their coworkers. But history, all of the reading that I've done about women, even when we were not allowed to be in unions, were that we were always there. We were always there supporting our men that were out on strike. We were always out there picketing. It's myths. I don't know if it's because companies don't want us to attempt to organize women or what. Part of the problem of organizing women is that most women still have to go home and perform those domestic responsibilities that a household requires. That part of it means that they're not as accessible. They aren't as likely to go to the tavern and have a beer before they go home, and so you have access to them. If that were considered a major obstacle, I suppose women are more difficult to organize. But as far as them understanding the goals of the trade union movement or the goals of being organized into a union, I don't think that's a problem. It truly, women are bright and they're out there and they're looking and they're interested not only in themselves but their work environment and the rights of coworkers, etc. I don't think that's just something that men have in common. It's just false, totally false in my opinion.
What does the future hold for the clothing and textile industry?
That's really a good question. If our legislation doesn't get passed, I think the future for our industry is dismal. It will be a cottage industry. It will be an industry that, as long as you've got people in China working for 16 cents an hour average, and people in Hong Kong working for $1.25, and people in Sri Lanka working for 30 cents an hour, we just simply cannot compete, even if we were to go back to minimum wage. I truly think it's dismal if we can't get some legislation passed to assist us. Our union is into a lot of kinds of work other than just clothing and textile, but that segment of it, I think that the legislation is crucial.
Would you like to close with any particular comments or analyses or words for our listeners?
Well, I guess basically that although I think that the road to seeing women as 50% of the decision-making positions in any union are far away, I think it's still the most likely place for that to happen. I think women in unions is still the best mechanism for them to get equality on the job, to learn the skills, to get more active in communities or whatever. But I guess it's a little discouraging to see that it is still so far down the road for many of us.
This is Nita Brueggemann with Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. Nita, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna tell you all a story about a little southern town. The houses were kept up real nice, but the people were kept down. It was built back on a river, right next to a hill. Most all of the people, they worked down in the mill. I'm talking about J.P. Stevens, way back in What's That River Road. And I feel so good, hey, I got the union in my soul. Now there's some things you can count on, some things don't ever stop, like a lot of folks being on the bottom and a few way up on top. And if you ain't got the money, they sure ain't got the time. The way they treat their workers, it's next door to a crime. I'm talking about J.P. Stevens, laying back in What's That River Road. And I feel so good, hey, I got the union in my soul. But through the spring and summer, 1974, they stood on every gate and they knocked on every door. They organized together, and when their work was done, bosses stood there crying, cause the working folks had won. I'm talking about J.P. Stevens, way back in What's That River Road. And I feel so good, hey, I got the union in my soul. Years have taught us the hardest lesson yet. If we don't stick together, well, stuck is what we get. But down in Roanoke Rapids, they got their union strong. You gotta help them get a contract, don't let them wait too long. I'm talking about J.P. Stevens, laying back in What's That River Road. And I feel so good, hey, I got the union in my soul.